Hello and welcome to Open Mind UFO Radio. I am your host, Alejandro Rojas, and I am here with Martin. What the hell are you up to, Willis?
Yo, that's me.
Yeah, you've always got something going on. This morning you're like, oh, I'm in an office, I'm here or there. It's like you have all these secret projects or something. Like are you working for the government or something like
that? These are black projects, and wow. Yes. That's why I shaved my head. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. It's all part of the gig.
Uh-huh. Wow. Mm-hmm. I thought so.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's cool.
Working on, let's see, zero gravity propulsion right now. It's going pretty good. Yeah.
What are you really working on though?
Antiques. How boring, huh?
Yeah. No, I think that's cool. I love antiques.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm cataloging away at an auction gig.
Oh, neat. So that's fun. That, to me, is exciting. I don't know about everyone else, but, you know, I haven't gotten a chance to watch in a while. I used to be addicted to Antiques Roadshow. And then I got a girlfriend. And
I think you're doing better with a girlfriend.
Yeah, well, so I love antiques. I think that's exciting what you're up to, buddy.
Yeah, well, it is for me, but most people, like, you know, don't want anything. It's old stuff. But to me, there's a history and story with everything, so I really like that.
You know who else has some exciting things going on right now?
Who?
Chris Rutkowski.
Really?
Yeah, he's my guest for today. And his group did a Canadian UFO survey that they released last week. It was reviewing UFO sightings for 2015. And boy, has this report taken the media by storm. Steam is cool too. But yeah, steam can be explosive, right? Not only the Canadian news, but the American news, Fox News, CNN. It's all over the place about UFO sightings in Canada because of his report. And luckily, even though he's in the middle of this media storm, he was able to make some time and we were able to talk for a while. So I'm real happy about that.
Wow. Amazing. You know, I've been actually trying to reach Chris for my show. So I'll let a little time go by before I reach out again.
Yeah, don't feel bad.
We don't want to have our shows with the same guests, you know, right?
I know, huh? I try to space it too. But, yeah, he was able to fit me in between a couple interviews, and he's got his job also, so he's a busy fella. But, yeah, so I'm really happy. I think he felt like he owed me a little bit too because he was a speaker at the UFO Congress this year.
That's right.
Which was really cool. It's great to hang out with him there. And I didn't even get to talk to him about it because I sat him next to Jacques Vallée, who was a hero of his, and we mentioned him a couple times in our interview, but I wanted to get more into that. But we just ran out of time, as you know how that is when you get talking on these interviews.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
So, yeah, that's our guest for today. But before we do that, we've got UFOs in the news. We always let you start it off. What's your UFO news story you want to start off with today, Martin?
Well, I'm going back in time a bit, back to February
17th. Got to get back in time.
February 17th, 1991. This is a MUFON report, but it's a Netherlands UFO witness recounts military encounter.
Yeah.
And this was a witness in the Netherlands at Soetsenburg, and this is a MUFON case report that Roger Marsh has posted. And this gentleman was outside with another cadet, and he came to a central parking lot at 3 a.m. He quotes that he saw a big circle in the sky straight on top of us. It had no shape, but only lights slowly rotating anti-clockwise and the light points itself did not rotate. The colors were in a liquid manner. Now, I find that interesting because you hear a lot of people mm-hmm. talking about sort of a liquidy-looking light or lights. The object was large, and the witness wondered exactly what it was, and he estimated it was 30 to 50 meters, which is up to 150 feet or so in diameter. And it was more or less a circular shape. And then at first he thought it was a blimp, but then he didn't know. It doesn't really make sense for that type of shape to be a blimp. And it started to rotate faster and faster and suddenly took off at a really incredible speed to the west. And a couple of seconds, we felt a short, hard wind blowing, which stayed on top of us like a downwash from a helicopter. Now, you don't often hear about that. A lot of times you hear about these things taking off and everything. You never hear about any sonic boom mm-hmm. or anything like this. So anyway, I just thought it was a great recounted sighting.
Yeah, I love this one. This is really interesting. He said he was terrified by it. And I like this one statement he made too, where it moved off so quickly that kind of extreme acceleration would turn a human into liquid.
Oh, right. Yes, he did say that later on, right.
Yeah.
And, that's always one of the mysteries of this whole thing,
mm-hmm.
is how the occupants don't, get totally turned into jello.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so great case. I think that one's really interesting, too, that this guy was so, freaked out by it. He's talking about it years later and so vividly. But yeah, pretty interesting one. Thank you for that one, buddy.
Sure.
I want to talk about an older one too, but not as old. This is 2004, and this is actually in the area where I used to live, sort of, in the suburbs of Denver.
Colorado?
Yeah, Wheat Ridge. Mm-hmm. So, in fact, I went to Wheat Ridge High School, which is nearby this area. But this is a police officer. In 2014, I think I might have said 2004, I meant 2014, so just a couple years ago. But it was June 2014, this police officer's in Anderson Park at about 1 a.m., and he sees some multicolored lights through the trees. He said there were five or six lights. He believed there were two red, two blue, two green. They were moving along behind the trees on the other side of a softball field, and then he says they just turned off all at the same time, so he felt that they were under, intelligent control. He thought maybe there were lights on an ATV, but he couldn't hear anything. He went to the area, and there were no tracks or anything, and you do see in all the pictures and everything that there's a road, but these lights are past that road. And then there's a river on the other side of the road, so that's kind of odd that they were there. Anyway, he couldn't figure out what they were. He said that he also saw in his headlights what looked like snow, but it wasn't snowing, although it was cold.
Mm.
A little chilly that night, but this was in June, so even in Colorado it doesn't snow in June, June 19th. It's actually pretty warm during that period of time. He said he even saw some sort of frost on the ground in the area. He then went back, and there were some security cameras in the area, and checked those security cameras. And sure enough, the security cameras caught these objects on video as well. And so he provided that video to MUFON. This is another MUFON case that Roger Marsh wrote about. And in the video, you do see some lights. I mean, it's not too different, except they're moving steadily along. You would think the lights, when you look at the video, it are maybe on a bike or on a vehicle, but it is past the road. He did provide these videos to MUFON. This is a MUFON case, another one written up by Roger. However, the video is really small, so if you can, kind of blow it up like by 200%. And you could see it better. And you see these lights beyond the trees. So it's a really interesting case. I think it's interesting that a police officer who's out in his car at night driving around all the time would think that this was something odd. So I think it's a pretty interesting case. Now, remember, some people have said, oh, this is kind of boring, I don't see much. But that's because the video is so small. People are kind of complaining. So you do have to... even if you full screen it, it's small, so you have to kind of go into your go in there and like do the 200% where you zoom into it. But yeah, kind of cool case.
It is, and I think it's, I mean, of course he's an officer, he can get surveillance tapes, and the fact that he went that far shows one more reason to kind of respect his research into it himself,
Yeah, so pretty cool. That's an interesting one. So people should check that out. But before we're done, I want to talk about another one that made some big news in the media, and I think this is really fun. And did you see this? An addition to billionaire Yuri Milner's Breakthrough Initiative, where he's going to send a bunch of tiny satellites to
Yes.
Alpha Centauri.
I can't even imagine that they are even talking about, I mean, you hear about it would take 100,000 years to get there, at 37,000 miles an hour, which we know. So they're expecting some type of different drive or something.
Yeah, so this is cool. So it's not something new as far as the idea of how they're going to do it, but it's exciting that they're actually going to do it. I mean, in Star Trek, they've had this idea before because it is a, scientists have talked about it before. There's a solar sail.
Right.
Or
Oh, this is a laser sail, though, isn't it?
well, that's what I'm going to explain here. For
Spoiler.
God's sakes.
Okay.
Yeah. So this one, what I was about to say was, although, typically they're called solar sails, this one's a light sail. It's using light from a different source other than the sun. And so what this is a light, a big sail of that, photons hit upon it, and that makes it move across the vacuum of space. As you mentioned, in this case, they're going to use lasers. Now, in order to do that, they have to have a big array of lasers here on the Earth that shoot at these things to make them move. Now, that's all exciting, but in order for these to actually move, they have to be extremely lightweight because photons, obviously, it's not like we're feeling the weight of photons hitting upon us. As light hits upon us, we can't feel it at all. So it's a very weak force. But what makes this possible are microchips. So the microchips have gotten so small that they're able, on a tiny chip about the size of a postage stamp, that's your spaceship essentially. So they have
Wow.
a camera on there, the directional, like the navigation. All of their other telemetry, everything's fitting on a tall or a tiny stamp size microchip. So they have this chip they attach to the sail. They put this sail out there and then they shoot this laser at it. This laser, by the way, this is interesting too. It takes 100, something like 100 something gigawatts. I better double check. It's like 100.
Wow.
Thousand, where is that? So I always think of gigawatts when I think of
Back to the Future.
Back to the Future, and that was something like 1.3 gigawatts or something. And Dr. What's His Face was freaking out about where the heck are we going to get this many gigawatts. Yeah, it's 100 gigawatts. So you can imagine it's quite a bit, but they only have to have the laser shooting for like 20 minutes because it only takes these things 20 minutes to get to top speed, and that top speed is 20% the speed of light.
Amazing.
Isn't that
Wow.
incredible? So they're going to get up to that speed in 20 minutes.
That is unbelievable. I can't believe this thing's so small.
I
So,
know.
and what's it going to do once it possibly gets there in so many
Yeah.
years?
So it's really difficult. The difficult parts are, first of all, the sail to hit the laser. You have to be really precise. So the laser's got to hit the sail just right in order to get it, and to get it to moving along. So that's that. Also, they figure that when it's moving at that speed and at this distance. It's going to take them 20 years to get there, actually, at this speed. So they're going to be sailing for a long time. But they figure that each of these little guys is probably going to hit at least four dust particles. And depending on where the particle hits, could destroy the entire craft. Because, of course, even a tiny dust particle can be devastating moving at those speeds. A dust particle hitting like you or I, if we were to be traveling at the 20,000 or 20% the speed of light, would be devastating, and we would probably die, and it would be ugly, really gory and awful.
Wow.
But that's why they're going to send a bunch of them. So hopefully that they all get there. Once they get there, they're only going to have a few hours to collect all the data that they can get. So they'll have their camera, will they take pictures, and they're not even sure of what other devices are going to be able to fit on this other on this chip to collect. So of course they want to be able to get spectro stuff. I can't say it. Spectrometry. I'm not looking at the word, but for some reason the word is not coming out. No, you're closer than I am, though. But anyways, essentially where they look at the makeup of the atmosphere and stuff like that to figure out what the atmosphere is like out there. In particular, they're going to be sending it to habitable or suspected possibly habitable planets. So planets in these Goldilocks zone they talk about where it's possible for life to exist. So once they gather this data, they're going to shoot a laser back to Earth to send all of these pictures and stuff. So they're sending it via lasers, which is another difficult part.
Wait. I don't understand. How can they – where's the laser going to be?
On this little stamp.
This little tiny stamp is going to have a laser?
Yeah. So the little stamp, that's another thing it's got to have.
Things.
I know. Isn't it amazing? They're going to have a little laser – and it's going to shoot the data back to Earth. And here's another difficult part, because it's got to aim really well, of course, to get that laser to hit Earth. So it's another one of the challenges. Then that data going at the speed of light is going to take 4 years to get here.
Wow.
Isn't that incredible? So then the data will be collected, hopefully, and we'll be able to have pictures of our neighbors at Alpha Centauri there.
Wow, I can't even imagine how someone could put something like this together.
Yeah.
And even conceive of the whole thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, space flight anyway takes extreme precision.
Yes.
So there are so many things that have to work correctly anyway. So, pretty exciting project. They just announced it last week. Someone was commenting, this is old news. Well, I don't know. I guess it depends on how you experience time and what you figure to be old, but it's less than a week old news, actually. Maybe they thought it was the older stuff. But
right.
Mm-hmm. So it's a new project. He's going to spend his last project was to give money to SETI. He was giving $100 million to SETI. This project, he's also spending $100 million, and this $100 million is to build a prototype, just to build the prototype.
Jeez, unbelievable.
Yeah.
Wow.
But he wants to do it, so which is great because, imagine it. How extraordinary is that to get some data and perhaps pictures from this, place that's like four light years away, this neighboring star system.
Amazing. Well, someone like that is going to go down in history. I think that's probably what he's doing, preserving his name in history.
Yeah.
If he really does this, if he pulls it off.
So we'll see. I think he's going to try. So, and it doesn't seem like it's too – I think it's all doable. I mean, these are things that are possible. Whereas NASA sending people to Mars, which they feel they're going to do, they actually have some more difficult challenges for that. Mm-hmm. For instance, they don't know how they're going to shield the spacecraft from radiation. So –
yeah, that's pretty important.
Yeah, exactly. So it's all exciting stuff. Speaking of which, this is really exciting regarding space stories. This weekend, they began to inflate the module, or at least attach. Maybe they didn't
On the
inflated.
space station?
Yeah, on the space station that was built by UFO
Bigelow.
enthusiast Robert Bigelow's company. Yeah, Bigelow Aerospace.
Right, wow.
How cool
Yeah,
is
it's
that?
exciting times. Exciting times in space.
I feel like it's like one of our UFO buddies has built this space capsule. A couple, because of course he works, Colm Kelleher is his lead scientist for BAS, the UFO and paranormal exploring section. And so yeah, and he works on this too. So it's like some UFO buddies have built this device that's now going on the ISS.
Amazing, isn't it?
It is amazing times, my friend.
Yes. And you have to have deep pockets to do what they're doing. And
Yeah.
I'm glad they have the interest. That's all I have to say.
So there we go. There's UFO news for the week. You got anything else to add?
That's good for me.
All right. Well, thanks again for coming on and talking UFO news. And we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you very much. Always a pleasure.
All right. We'll see. Talk to you later, Baldy.
All right.
Okay, so let's go ahead and see what Chris Rutkowski has to say. I am very excited to welcome to the show Chris Rutkowski. Hello.
Hello there, Alejandro.
Thank you so much. I know you're super busy because you're kind of famous right now. You're maybe getting more media attention than you ever have. Not that you're a stranger to media attention, but you're getting a lot right now, which is wonderful.
Yeah, I don't know whether I'm famous or infamous, but one of the two. And it definitely seems that the 2015 survey has received more attention than other years. You know, there've been a couple of years where it's been hectic, but certainly nothing like this.
Well, I'm excited to have you on the show. There's a paranormal sort of phenomena that happens in my brain. And maybe you can help me out with this. There are people such as yourself that I could swear you've been on the podcast before, but when I looked into it, I was looking at, I think, pictures that I had used for you or something. You haven't been on the podcast before. I think I interviewed you for something else, but not the podcast.
Yeah, we've met several times and we've talked, and I don't recall being on your podcast, unless, of course, you know, the government has erased that from our memories and all record is gone. So,
Right, that's a good point. That could be what happened.
yeah.
So, and then of course you were at the UFO Congress as a speaker, which was awesome. It was wonderful to have you. So, we'll get into this. Now, what's going on right now is this great survey that you put out, and that's why you're getting so much attention. But I want to hold off on that for a minute and ask you about some other things, such as, since it's the first time on the podcast and maybe some of the listeners are not as familiar with your work. Let's start off with the beginning. What got you into UFOs, and maybe tell us a little bit about your background as well.
Well, sure. I've been around the UFO scene and ufology for quite a long time. I actually met Alan Hynek early on in the 1970s, and sort of worked with the Center for UFO Studies. But at the same time, I met Stan Friedman for the first time. Started working with him. It all started back in the mid 1970s, when there was actually quite a significant flap of UFOs going on across Canada. And about the same time, I was just entering university, and in the astronomy department, my prof was actually a little frustrated because these people were calling in all the time that they had seen UFOs, and he knew that UFOs were nonsense, and he was just getting so annoyed he just couldn't get his work done. So I happened to be in his office when a call came in, and I said, "Well, you know what? Why don't you just give me the phone calls whenever you get those cases? And I'll take them off your hands. That way you won't be bothered with them." I figured, what a great way to suck up. I mean, assist my professor in his serious research. And so I started talking with the people who were calling in reporting UFOs. And I was astounded because these people were not as crazy or out of it to the extent that I'd been led to believe by my professors in astronomy. In fact, people just simply wanted to know what it was that they were seeing. Certainly, some of them sounded easy enough to explain, like stars and planets and a few other things, but some of them were very puzzling. And I took it upon myself to go out and investigate. I went throughout the countryside, visiting people in their farms and homes, and I was fascinated by what it was that people were seeing and reporting. In many cases, I had no idea what these things were that people were seeing, the disc-shaped objects, strange objects with flashing lights that hovered and landed in fields and took off again, and that type of thing. It's very curious to me. And it was a matter of, several months later, where I was asked by my professor to sort of recap what I had heard from people, what were people actually seeing. So I agreed to do a small departmental presentation, but word got around that somebody was going to talk about UFOs, and it got leaked out into the public. And before I knew it, when I gave my presentation, there were 500 people in the largest auditorium at the university.
Oh, my gosh.
There were TV cameras everywhere. And and the next thing I know, I was Canada's Fox Mulder. And it was quite significant. So it's been quite an interesting ride. As I say, I've met some interesting people. I haven't been to a lot of conferences. It was like a pleasure, and thank you for inviting me to the Congress this past year. I do a lot of writing. I have 10 books out, all of them available, or not all of them, most of them available on Amazon if people look them up. And I've been on a number of other programs. I was on the original Unsolved Mysteries, Robert Stack and all that, back in those days. And I've been on a number of other programs on TV from NBC and A&E and so forth, just trying to talk about what it is that people really are seeing. And that's kind of where I come from, in the sense that I'm curious as to what people really are seeing. And I know all the hyperbole about the aliens coming here from whatever planet, and they escaped from the Las Vegas underground bases to go to Las Vegas, and that type of thing. I hear that, but what are people really seeing, and what's the foundation upon which all of ufology is based? And those are the actual reports. So in 1989, I had tried to actually figure out how many cases there were in Canada in a single year. And to do that, I had to ask my colleagues across the country. And we pulled our resources and data. And I produced the first Canadian UFO survey, giving a snapshot of what people, at least in this country, were actually reporting. And over the years, we've refined our methods a little bit, and we are getting what I think is a really interesting look at what people really are seeing, because we get reports not only through UFO groups such as MUFON and Peter Davenport's site and other online sources, but also directly from witnesses. We actually do get cases directly from government officials through some of the agencies. We do get reports from pilots and air traffic controllers. So we do have a really good idea what it is that people are seeing, at least in Canada. And the numbers are actually quite interesting.
Mm-hmm. And are your numbers so much different than U.S. numbers?
Typically, we're a factor of 10 smaller than the United States, which actually does work very well, because we've determined that it seems that the number of UFO reports in a Canadian province, the equivalent of a state, is related to the population. In other words, there's more people around to see something, though, than we get more reports. And so the numbers are consistent. The trouble is we don't really have much in the way of comparison, because MUFON's database is sort of unto itself. In fact, they only really got going on their case management system in an intense way over the past 10 years. So we existed long before them. This is our 27th year of producing the Canadian UFO survey this year. In fact, we're up to 17,000 UFO reports on file, which actually beats Blue Book, which is quite interesting. We do find that the numbers are related to population in terms of how many there are, but there are variations in different areas of the country. We have data on whether there are more objects of a certain color versus others, like orange is more common than green, And we know that there are times of day when objects are seen more commonly, and what shapes are more common. So we're getting interesting data on the characteristics of the sightings themselves, which is giving some insight into what people really are experiencing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you also make that data available as far as the numbers and everything, so people can even crunch their own numbers, right?
Absolutely, and we've made it available in a couple of different ways, not only in PDFs, but also the raw data Excel files, although I think we're changing that over. I think we have the 2015 data is only available on PDF, but you can still grab it, mm-hmm. look up particular regions and do some crunching. And, of course, the serious researchers, we do make some of the data available upon request, so it's actually searchable that way. One of these days, we are actually working. The fellow who's working on this with me in terms of the data, his name is Jeff Dittman, and we're working now to move all of our data online so that sometime in the future, it will be possible for anyone to look up all the data for the past 25 or so years.
Mm-hmm. So getting into the shapes and the sizes and the colors, you said orange is the most popular color?
Yes. Yeah. It's still the most popular, although, there are many, white objects seen. Green often means fireball, so mm-hmm. they can actually lead some insight into what is actually being observed by the witness. The shapes are quite interesting because the classic flying saucer has long disappeared almost from mm-hmm. from UFO data. Triangles were very popular for quite a few years. It seems that the most popular shape right now is round or spherical. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting way that even during the relatively short history of the time we've been doing the study, the characteristics of UFOs themselves have changed, which to me suggests is a real phenomenon, because it's not something static. It's not something that's stagnant and that just sort of exists without any context. These are things that people are actually observing that seem to have different characteristics depending on the time of day, the year, the movement, that type of thing. And it's quite interesting to look at the data in a broader context, so that it's not just one particular case, that it's representative of hundreds upon hundreds of cases.
Mm-hmm. As far as orange balls of light, which seems like, there's an increase of that mm-hmm. in Canada, there's also in the last few years been an increase. It was getting more attention, I think, last year or maybe last year about orange orbs in the UK. It's been mm-hmm. getting attention here. A lot of the suspicion in the UK was that this was due to an increase in the use of Chinese lanterns. Do you feel that's mm-hmm. the case?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, we do know that is the case many times here in Canada. In fact, we noticed a sharp uptick in the summers, especially in the fall, of orange lights moving in the sky, especially in groups of, 3, 4, 10, that type of thing. And we've been able to track down quite a few of them to releases of Chinese lanterns during particular festivals or ceremonies, weddings, and so forth. The movie Tangled seemed to make it all very attractive for people to send out mm-hmm. Chinese lanterns. So that's done, and we actually have found people who have been able to trace back some of the lights that were seen to people releasing things from fields. So we suspect that's a big part of it. Certainly not all of the cases are ascribable to those types of explanations, but I think we have to take those into account, and we do. In fact, we find that only about 12% of the reports received last year are listed as unexplained. Mm-hmm. And even after we look at those 12%, we can whittle that down a little bit to about 2 or 3 or 4% of what we call the high quality unknowns, where the witnesses have cooperated. We have data, we've looked at flight plans, we've looked at mm-hmm. What else is in the sky and so forth. So but even when you're only looking at a few percent, when you're looking at a database of 17,000 cases,
yeah.
you're still looking at a significant number of cases that leave you shaking your head.
And that 2 or 3%, what does that boil down to you? Like, how many highly unusual cases do you feel that you have in your records?
Well, for example, in 2015, that's 2 or 3 dozen cases, which is not bad, I
Yeah.
say. That gives us a good chance to try and figure out, that they are unusual in some particular way. Jeff has attempted to look at just the unknowns with regard to the rest of the cases, and they do tend to have a lot of similar characteristics, again suggesting they're part of the same phenomenon. That unknowns are UFO cases that simply are better observed than others in some cases. So there could be a lot of things going on that allows us to say that there is a real phenomenon that science should be taking a look at.
Yeah, the local MUFON here in Arizona has, I think, one of the best directors of investigations in the country. And he, Dennis Friermuth is his name. He does a great job identifying sightings, and they typically have, their unknowns are only around 4%. And I know that frustrates a lot of people, but for me, that's really exciting because that does boil down to, similar to you, at least maybe a dozen sightings that they have thoroughly examined and cannot find an answer for. And for me, that's pretty exciting. I know that there's been, a lot of work done to try to identify those things, honest, work to get that done, and they haven't been able to do so.
Yeah, and the other problem is, and this is prevalent throughout ufology, not just in Canada, but it's really appalling from an investigative standpoint how few cases are really thoroughly investigated. Now, in Canada, I'm going to say that we have a reason for that because we have far fewer investigators and a lot more geography, in the sense that here in Manitoba, there's myself and a few of my colleagues doing the work, Jeff Dittman and a few others. But in terms of investigations, in fact, we only had a field investigator from MUFON start up this past year, and he's certainly not run off his feet. But in Saskatchewan, the neighboring province, there are no investigators whatsoever. So if there was a sighting, in Saskatchewan somewhere, I'm not sure who would investigate it. We certainly would hear about it via email or phone calls or through media. But to investigate, and just to give you a sense, where I am sitting right now speaking with you in Winnipeg, the capital city in Saskatchewan, just the next neighboring province over is Regina. And it's about an 8-hour drive one way. So just imagine if, and that's the capital city, and of course Saskatchewan is quite large, and to drive into the far north of Saskatchewan would easily be 20 hours drive one way. So it's sometimes very impractical to investigate cases like that, and we just simply don't have the resources to do everything. So it's quite surprising we have as good data as we do.
Now, what's curious is you mo mentioned the prevalence of triangular aircraft sightings or UFOs, and that's always fascinating to me. I've had people on to discuss it. Last week, I had a gentleman on to discuss it, and he feels he had his own incredible sighting, and he was certain that what he saw was probably man-made. But others don't feel that way, and have also done, extensive research. So it's a confusing thing, although it's amazing. I mean, some of the most amazing sightings are these alleged triangular craft. What are your feelings on those sightings? Do you say they've increased out there? Have you all, as Canada, had its triangular UFO flap, or did those only start in the last couple of decades, or what do you make of that phenomenon?
Well, we certainly do get a lot of reports of triangular formations of lights. The actual physical objects are, as you know, very rarely seen. It's very rare for somebody to see an actual physical triangle itself. Usually we get the reports of triangular formations of lights, and the inference is that they're on a triangular object. And to me, that's it, I find that suspicious. Not in the sense I don't believe the witnesses, but it's just, to me, it's more likely that there are three separate lights or objects that just coincidentally be in a triangle. Of course, any three objects form a triangle. So
exactly.
That's not particularly unusual. So I think we're actually probably seeing, when we hear so many reports of triangles, I think the problem may be in the witnesses' descriptions, because they're often a little bit too vague and not as well supported. For example, I often hear a witness tell me that what they saw was round. Well, what does that mean exactly? Are you talking like a frisbee? Are you talking spherical? Mm-hmm. And even witnesses' descriptions of how far away things are. It's very common to have a witness say that this thing was 1 or 2 or 3 miles away. Well, if the object, in their opinion, was the size of a basketball, and I actually have got this, it was somebody who was very sincere that the object they had witnessed was an orange light the size of a basketball 2 miles away. Well, in reality, you couldn't see an object the size of a basketball 2 miles away. So, and this is why it's so important for investigators to often sit with the witness and have him or her, you know, really point out where things were, try and get additional witnesses, draw things. And it's a very, very protracted exercise and a lot of darn hard work. And I don't blame people for not wanting to do it, but it does cause problems. And you know, when we're trying to get data to do analysis on, these are actually some of the issues we have to deal with.
Having been a field investigator for several years, I haven't done, I talk to a lot of people, but I haven't done the field work like I used to. But when I did, one of the issues, you know, I found was just like you talked about, they would often say round when they meant a point of light. And that's a big difference.
Absolutely. In fact, that's the one thing that we sit with. There's a couple of other people, Ashley Kircher and Kelly Smith, who do a lot of our data entering. And when you're looking through a report and somebody says, well, what I saw was a series of orbs. Well, to me, an orb is a spherical ball, like a basketball, I suppose. And what they had actually seen were lights in the sky, which are points of light that were moving in the sky. But the mind does interpret that as being some sort of sphere. And because orbs are so much in the mind of people in the UFO field now, it's often just simply assumed that a distant light in the sky is actually some sort of spherical orb. And the two are not consistent. I agree. Even the terminology, when we're doing the analysis, causes issues. So it's no wonder that even something as intrinsically simple as data analysis of UFO reports can get very, very complicated.
In this 2015 report, are there any cases that stand out to you? Maybe a couple that you thought were particularly spectacular or interesting.
Well, to me, one of the most interesting came from northern Quebec. A truck driver was driving last fall, and he said that as he was driving along an isolated part of the road, he saw a light come up behind him, a blue light, and he thought it was a semi wanting to pass. So he pulled over slightly to the side of the road, and wouldn't you know it, this light moved as if to pass, but then when it got level with his truck, the light just simply disappeared. So, straight out of Close Encounters, the movie.
Yeah.
Some of those cases are very, very intriguing.
And have you had your own sighting?
No, I've never seen anything. You know, I've been out with a lot of individuals to some of the hot spots. I've traveled across Canada to places where UFOs are frequently seen. And nothing's ever manifested that I just, you know, couldn't explain. We've seen lights at the end of the road. I'm sure your listeners will be familiar with that term, where you're looking down an isolated road and a light appears on the roadway in the distance that moves from side to side and sometimes comes towards you and sometimes moves away. And cars have been known to chase such lights at high speeds that the lights continue to zip away. So I've been to some areas to see those. But they haven't really struck me as being all that unusual.
So, This report, I mean, you've been really busy. So again, thank you for making the time because, like, even today, you've been doing interviews. I think you said you did one with Yahoo. You were on, CTV did a great report and an interview with you. And I think I've seen CNN even. I've seen it all over the place. NBC. Your report has really taken the media by storm. Why do you think that is, that this year this report has gotten so big?
Here in Canada, and I think the effect is the same in the United States, there's a rule in journalism called anything but election. And so the media are a little tired of doing nothing but political stories, so they're looking for something a little bit unusual. So that's certainly one factor. The other thing is that we're not really going out and talking in terms of aliens visiting us and giving us telepathic information and that type of thing. We're looking at the UFO phenomenon from a real scientific standpoint, and I think there's a hunger for that because there's so much sensational stuff out there. Even some of the TV shows are really over the top in terms of gee whiz, are the aliens trying to communicate with us? But I think people are looking for the serious information, what it is that people really are seeing, what is the average person seeing, what are the characteristics of the lights. And because this is such a common denominator, and polls have shown that about 10% of the North American population believe they've seen UFOs, it strikes a chord with so many people that they can relate to. The close encounters are really a very small fraction of the caseload. Most people simply see lights in the sky that they can't explain. And I think the greater proportion of the viewership and readership of the media are falling in that category, that they're simply seeing a few things that don't seem to be stars and planes and satellites. And it relates to the average person, because those things are fairly common, and almost everybody has a friend or an uncle or an aunt or somebody who they drive to work with who's seen something.
Well, I have a similar perspective, of course. I mean, to document the sightings and what's going on, and that's where my passion lies as well, because it feels like, and I'd like to hear what you think. It when people get distracted away from that, then they and you hear this a lot. I'm so bored with the nuts and bolts. I want to see what they're saying, what they're doing and what they're up to. But I feel that the nuts and bolts, at least the tracking the data, is really important because.
Well, certainly. That's exactly right. That it is important because this is the foundation upon which all the speculation is based. So all the discussion about what planet they're from and what the message is and whether they're green or blue or tall white or whatever, all of that is speculation without any backing up of proof. And what the whole constituent of ufology is based on these reports from the average person, and admittedly some of the cases are quite remarkable, but this is what really is being seen. So when you strip away all the other stuff, we know that these cases are real. We can document them. We know who said them. We know where they were located and so forth. This is what people really are seeing. Now let's try to build on this basis rather than to sort of go off far afield and try to come back and see if it fits in with the data. Go from the data outward rather than from outside into the data.
So you feel, it seems, that the data does, however, represent or makes an argument that this is a true phenomena, that all of these things being seen, we don't have necessarily explanations for.
Yeah, in fact, what we say is that there doesn't seem to be an easy or simple explanation than the 12%, and then when we dig a little deeper into the 1 or 2 or 3%, there doesn't seem to be a more elaborate explanation for some of these cases, although that doesn't mean they can't be explained if we have a little more information. Having said that, I think what we can say is If there isn't a real physical phenomenon called UFOs, and whatever that means, whether we're talking aliens or military tests or some sort of ball lightning or whatever, then at the very least there's a psychological or sociological phenomenon called UFOs. And by that I mean, psychologically and sociologically, maybe there's a need for people to interpret things in the sky or things that they don't understand in this way. Perhaps we are looking for salvation because our lives are so messed up here. The planet is polluted, and we're on the verge of nuclear war, and the economy is going down the tubes. We're looking for someone to solve this mess for us, and this is, I think, why people turn to contactees and the spiritual aspects of ufology, because they're looking for someone to save them from whatever is going on here on Earth. And that may contribute to the UFO phenomenon in some way. And in either case, whether it's physical or something from the behavioral and personal sciences, humanistic sciences, science should be taking a look at the UFO phenomenon more. The last time there was a study like this was, of course, Blue Book and Condon back in they finished in 1970. Since then, science has been very reluctant to look into the UFO phenomenon, although there have been a few people who've been publishing papers in scientific journals, peer-reviewed journals from time to time. I actually have two or three papers like that myself. And I think it's important to try and get the scientific community to take a more serious look. At the very least, there's some decent PhD theses that are waiting to be written on UFOs from whatever angle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jacques Vallée made that argument before that, and I think it was even something he said at the UN when they were arguing for studies to be opened up, was that if the government doesn't officially look into this topic and give, their findings, then people are just going to speculate and build all of these wild assumptions because they're not going to have any guidance, and what he predicted has become true.
Absolutely, and I have to agree with him that I think because the scientific community has shied away, the vacuum has been filled by people who are speculating, people who are less qualified than some that have a particular axe to grind in some cases, and they're making names for themselves, getting a little more attention than they deserve.
Mm-hmm.
There's no question that I think the public has to be satiated, that people want to know, they're curious. This explains in some way why the media attention is so great on the Canadian UFO survey, because people are curious. The general public does want to have some information, and they're a little tired of hearing the stories. They want to know what's really going on, and looking at the hard data is at least one way of reaching that.
So, and going further, I guess, starting to get into your own speculation, do you feel that from what you've looked at in your research, that it is possible that an intelligent extraterrestrial civilization is visiting? Do you think it's that's definitely what is happening, or is it possible?
There's no question it's possible, and I have to say anything is possible.
Mm-hmm.
With my astronomy background, most of my colleagues agree that there probably is life out there somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we all know that the distance problem and how long it would take to travel and so forth makes it impossible in the most elaborate speculation. I know Stephen Hawking just this past week is proposing close to light speed travel between stars using light sails.
Mm-hmm.
That's just to the nearest star. So I know there's some speculation there, but in terms of the Star Trek, Star Wars kind of travel between stars, we have really no idea how to do that. However, and I make this point whenever I'm speaking to students or in colleges, the cell phone that I'm speaking to you on right now would have been completely unheard of as recently as 50 years ago. And I cannot speculate what I will be talking to you on or via 50 years from now because the technology is advancing so much. Mm-hmm. Well, there are stars relatively near our own sun that have planets around them that may have planets that are, a little bit older than our Earth. Not just 100 years, not just 1,000 years, but tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of years older. And if civilizations arose on those planets, it's possible that technological civilization might have figured out a way not to break the laws of physics and, pop here and there using some fuel that we haven't discovered, but maybe bending the laws of physics or using them in ways we simply haven't even dreamt of yet, so that interstellar travel could be possible in the future. And if somebody out there has figured that out, maybe, just maybe, they might have found something of interest here in this little pale blue dot, as Carl Sagan used to describe it, in this backwater arm of the Milky Way galaxy. Maybe. But it's wonderful to speculate, and we're currently living in the Steven Spielberg generation, or post-Steven Spielberg generation in some ways, that we take it for granted that aliens are here and they're possible, and it's possible to travel between the stars very easily. I mean, there's even a movie in theaters right now about an alien battling Batman. So, whether the aliens are here or not, we sort of take it for granted. Mm-hmm. But maybe, and I use this as a way of introducing science to kids, what would an alien look like? How do you travel between the stars? How do rockets work? How would a flying saucer fly if one really existed? Mm-hmm. It's a way of getting people thinking about science, and what a better way than to use UFOs as a way of thinking about science.
Mm-hmm. When I interview people who write movies or make movies, I like to ask about this seeming dichotomy that there is. Like you said, when it comes to entertainment, it's almost like a given that we will meet aliens or they're out there. And almost every movie about the future, somehow aliens are involved. Star Trek, Star Wars, all of that sort of thing. Although Star Wars was a long, long time ago, right?
Yeah, in a galaxy far, far away.
Far, far away. But at the same time, people are hesitant to say or even go on the record, less so these days, but more so even 10, 20 years ago, that aliens most likely exist. So it seems like this dichotomy, even though they're totally willing to feel like, oh yeah, aliens, when we look at the future, aliens will be involved. But if you ask right now, they're still hesitant to say it's a likely possibility.
Well, yeah, and especially science fiction authors who have been very reluctant to embrace the UFO theme as real. I mean, Asimov and Clark both dissed UFOs quite significantly. A lot of science fiction authors won't even talk about them because they find it so ridiculous. And these are the people who talk about aliens all the time, which is actually quite interesting. And I had my own personal experience where, back in, it goes back to the 70s again, when I was really getting into UFOs, I wanted to read as much as I could on the subject. And there, I had found a copy of an old pulp magazine called Flying Saucers from Other Worlds, which was originally a science fiction pulp called Other Worlds, and then got some flying saucer content through the Shaver Mystery and whatever. And that's another podcast. But I was trying to get more copies of this, and in the back of this issue of this pulp magazine from the 50s was the address of a fellow who was running a science fiction society in my own city back in the 50s. So I thought, well, if I contact him and he's still around, maybe he'll have some copies. So I contacted him, and not only did he have extra copies, he said the science fiction society was still meeting in his home. So I went to the next meeting, and I was surrounded by people who were really into science fiction. Like, this was before Star Trek really got taken off, but it was the people who were really super into science fiction. They knew all the authors, and some of them had met them personally. One of the people was actually in First Fandom from the 30s. It was really quite fascinating, and they were a little hostile to the UFO phenomenon. And when I was introduced as being the UFO guy, one of their spokespersons said, "Well, you know, we're not into that. We're not into that UFO stuff because we're into science fiction, and everybody knows that UFOs are nothing more than, oh, wait, yeah, you know what? You can stay. Yes, sit down. We'll talk."
Yeah, just that strange disconnect.
The strange disconnect. So once they realized that UFOs were, in fact, science fiction in their view, I was fine to talk with the group and then see what their heads were at. So it's been an interesting ride.
Pretty strange. So what do you say, because I'm sure you get this, because we get this all the time, and when people come to you and are like, you know, well, I'm talking to the aliens, or I know people who are talking to the aliens, or you know this person who's popular out there speaking or whatever, who say they're talking to the aliens. Why are you worrying about the sightings when we can hear what the aliens are saying? What do you tell those people?
Well, you know, there's no question that ufology is a significant part faith. You know, their belief is a very significant part of ufology. And, you know, if someone wants to say that they are in contact with the aliens and they speak to them every Sunday and they give them revelations, you know, that's cool. If that's you know, what you believe, I'm not going to diss you, because there would be no way for me to change your mind anyways. Is it possible that people are really in communication with aliens? I suppose it's possible, but I don't see the evidence. And when I usually pursue people who say they're in contact with aliens, and I ask them, well, can you be a little more descriptive about, you know, have them channel, you know, instructions on how to build a transporter, or can you have them at least, appear tomorrow afternoon in the sky so that I can take a photo of them and all this sort of stuff. And it's usually hyperbole about, well, humans aren't ready, and that's not how they work. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've studied the UFO literature for a lot longer than most people have been around studying it. And I looked at the contactee literature, and, you know, it was done a lot better in the 50s. Give me Aura Raines and Howard Menger and even George Adamski, who had some wonderful stories of encounters with aliens. And if you read what they're saying or what they said back in the 1950s, it's almost word for word what people are saying now about the aliens. Mm-hmm. So it's really nothing new. Certainly things haven't advanced. And in terms of humans aren't being ready for the message, or certain people are selected, and if I don't believe that I'm not going to see the aliens, well, you know what? If that's what it takes to see the aliens, then maybe give me the other aliens instead. Maybe they give me the aliens from Zeta Reticuli instead of Beta Pictoris.
Right. Yeah, I hear you. I mean, the latest message I got that was similar to that, and I hadn't responded. Maybe if that person's listening, then they'll hear my answer. But and they said the aliens told them that we need to get the message out. We need to quit trashing our planet, and we need to take care of our planet as soon as possible, or we're going to destroy ourselves. And it's like, well, that's really nothing new.
No.
If you read the news, people who don't believe in aliens at all are saying the same thing all the time. So how does that really add to any conversation, or really, we know that. We already know that.
Maybe we're talking about interstellar Greenpeace voyagers or something. I don't know. Yeah.
Right, and they're just one more group. So add them to the list of organizations or people out there who are advocating us taking better care of our planet. It's a long list. So like you, I mean, I'm open to the idea that it's possible. But, you know, the messages are all very New Agey, and you have, Deepak Chopra is telling us the same stuff, and he's not an alien. So it really doesn't.
But not that we know.
As far as we know, exactly. He may be, but there's just lots of people, or we also have our own instincts that tell us something similar. So,
yeah.
So like you said, and it even goes back further to the contactees who've been saying this for a very long time, but it hasn't necessarily, at least as far as we know, changed you know, how we live.
I agree. And I mean, you can say that you know, over the past, you know, how many years of ufology you want to go back, nothing's really changed. But I would disagree. I think the phenomenon itself has evolved.
Mm-hmm.
Close encounters are almost, I don't know, well, close encounters of the second kind are almost non-existent. So why is that?
You mean like the real exciting up-close UFOs?
The ones that leave marks on the ground and things like that. I mean, there was a time, like Ted Phillips is doing a fantastic job documenting physical traces.
Mm-hmm.
The physical traces are almost vanished completely from ufology. I don't even think we got one out of the 1,200 and something last year in Canada at all.
Mm-hmm.
And why is that? Because in the 70s and 80s, they were among the most common types of UFOs. The shapes have changed. People, you know, we now have images of, you know, we have the capability of taking videos and photographs, you know, not necessarily good ones, but we have the capability. So much has changed. And, you know, the fact that we, you know, we just looked at images from Pluto just a matter of months ago. And we talked about Stephen Hawking wanting to send robots to Alpha Centauri or Proxima Centauri. I mean, we're living in a very exciting age. And I think the notion that we're not alone is going to become more and more important because we do have this exploration instinct. We do want to find out. We do want to know if we are alone and give some meaning to our lives. So I think talking about UFOs not only is a good way to you know, bring some science into our lives, but bring some meaning into our lives as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, before I let you go, I want to ask you about something you had mentioned, and I want to talk about the Canadian government and UFOs. Now, their program, or at least their interests, kind of paralleled the U.S., and when the U.S. got out of the business, they pretty much got out of the business. But at least they did. I haven't looked at it in maybe a year or two. They had a great website of with their official documents and things like their investigation, like into Sag Harbor or some other significant UFO cases. Is that still up? And I mean, that was a pretty cool site.
Well, yeah, as a matter of fact, the Canadian government, you know, had its own parallel version of Blue Book. They worked in cooperation. There was Project Magnet and Project Second Story. One thing that is quite different is that Blue Book officially ended in the 70s, and Condon, you know, the report was in the 69-70. We really don't know much beyond that for the United States. But in Canada, things happened a little bit differently because the Canadian equivalent of the Smithsonian, which is called the National Research Council of Canada, was studying meteors and meteorites, and they wanted to actually find a landed meteorite, maybe still steaming from zipping through the atmosphere. And they needed a way of finding out where these things were, people who had seen them, how do you track them down? So they enlisted the RCMP, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, to investigate reports of lights in the sky. So, in effect, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police were investigating UFOs on behalf of the National Research Council, and these reports were routinely filed in the Archives of Canada. And they continued to do that right up until 1995. So we actually have records beyond Blue Book in Canada of official investigations into UFOs up until 1995, when it turns out that the office that was studying meteoritics in the National Research Council was closed because the interest was sort of shifted to the Canadarm and supplying American satellites with arms and things like that. But so that finished in 1995, but reports of UFOs and objects in the sky being seen continued to come in. And I was approached in the 1990s by somebody at the National Research Council, because I was in astronomy and I was at some meetings in Ottawa, and they asked me if I had any thoughts on what to do with the reports. And I said, well, you can always send them to me. I'll look at them. And by golly, if it wasn't a repeat of what happened when I was in first year astronomy in university, suddenly in the year 2000, I started receiving official reports of UFOs.
Wow.
And that continues to this day, and they are routinely included in the Canadian UFO survey every year. So in effect, we do have, you know, there was no cessation that includes disclosure. There never was this problem of disclosure in Canada. We have a continuous record of all the reports, some of which up until about, I think the latest one that's in the reports online, at least, are from sometime in the 80s. But if you can actually go to the National Archives of Canada, they're actually all there for anyone to look at. So that's very different from the United States.
Wow, that's great. And so now you receive the reports that the RCMP receive.
And in fact, the RCMP they're not doing it anymore. Although, admittedly, the RCMP still investigates reports from time to time, but they go into their own separate files, not necessarily in the National Archives and the National Research Council.
And then do you work with other government agencies that send you reports?
I've only received reports from Transport Canada, the RCMP, and the Canadian Forces.
That's great, and they all seem pretty open.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have any illusions that I'm getting all of them. I suspect that I'm only getting a small fraction, or just the occasional ones. But we certainly do get the pilot reports, reports from air traffic controllers, and from some forces personnel from Canadian Armed Forces bases. So we do get some good representative samples of not just civilian, but also official sources of UFOs.
Wow, great. Yeah, it reminds me of a story John Greenwald tells of trying to get some NORAD UFO information, and he couldn't, but then he called up the Canadian arm, and they were like, yeah, no problem, and they sent him tons of files.
Yeah, I mean, NORAD's name is all over some of the reports that we get up here. So, it's an interesting way to get data. Curiously enough, though, of course, the reports are about the same as anything you get from civilian researchers. Lights in the sky that could be anything, and the majority of them aren't very interesting at all. So, in many cases, what we're looking at is a parallel of the Ministry of Defense reports that. Were being obtained through our friends in England, that you get these thousands upon thousands of files of UFOs, but the vast majority of them aren't very interesting at all.
Well, thank you so much for being on. Right now, if you Google Canada UFOs, you're going to get pictures and videos of Chris talking about them. You are Canada UFOs.
And if you want to look at the survey itself, you go to survey.canadianuforeport.com. And that takes you to the webpage where all the links are to the surveys going back quite some time.
That's great. So you are kind of the representative of UFOs in Canada, and I can't think of a better person to be the representative for that because of your very grounded way of looking at this topic. I wish people, that had similar ideas when they thought of ufology when it comes to the U.S., but there's so many characters involved, some of them less discerning.
I'm still a character, Alejandro.
Oh, there's no doubt about that. We didn't get to get into – if people go see Chris's Facebook, you're going to see plenty of jokes and goofiness, which is also fun. But
yeah.
Thank you so much for being on the show, and congratulations on all the media attention that you're getting. It's positive, and it's putting this whole phenomenon, I think, for the most part, I haven't read one story that's really making fun of the topic.
Somebody was saying, they've been monitoring these things a little closer than me, that there's one radio announcer who was making a lot of fun of it. But, it comes with the territory.
Yeah. Yeah, and you probably, like me, even when you talk to a radio announcer, it seems radio announcers are more likely to have fun. It's fun to have fun along with them, really.
Well, absolutely. And this time, it's because both Canada and the United States have some elections going on. What I like to say, and this is an absolute true observation, that I think we definitely have the proof that the aliens have visited Earth and taken over the bodies and minds of certain people here on this planet, because how else can you explain politicians?
That's a very good point. And on that note, in this election season, we'll leave it at that. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much to Chris Rutkowski for being on the show. Really interesting stuff. I think he does some great work. We were so happy to have him at the UFO Congress this year, just a few months ago. He did a great talk. And by the way, you can get that talk on DVD by going to our website. You can go to the store and find that. Also, we do have a video portal, so streaming video service. For less than a price of a DVD, you can go subscribe to this video portal and have access to all of the lectures. So we don't have all of the 2016 UFO Congress lectures on that streaming service yet. However, we will soon, like within the next couple of weeks. And in fact, we have most of them up already. We have a lot from 2015, and then we have all of them from some of the other conferences like 2010, 2011. So we have tons and tons of lectures available on this streaming service, so I would highly recommend it. It's cheaper than Netflix. It's a good deal. You can go on, subscribe, and then have access to tons and tons of lectures. We've got exclusive lectures that, you know, no one's ever had before. Bob Lazar, for God's sakes. We've got Jacques Vallée. We have, Congressman Cook, the congressman from Utah who was at the citizen hearing for disclosure, who was convinced that UFOs are a real phenomena. So he talks about why he believes that. We have officials from France and from Chile and all over the place, just some incredible lectures. So you've got to check that out. You can find it all at openminds.tv. By the way, you can find Chris's stuff at uforum.blogspot.com. UFORum. Apparently Chris likes rum. No, I'm kidding. I think it's probably Uforum is actually it's probably an accurate acronym. I mean, but uforum.blogspot.com is a URL, so it's easy to remember. UFO rum. It's called Ufology Research. You can also look up Chris Rutkowski Ufology Research and you'll find it. But yeah, he's got a lot of info there. You can find the Canadian Report there as well. But like I said, he's all over the media. So it's funny, he's all over Facebook too. So you can find him on our Facebook, Open Minds UFO News, the group, making comments and adding stuff. And it's kind of funny talking to him because about these UFO cases, because he's so serious about his work, whereas he's just kind of a goofy guy overall. He likes making jokes and having fun. Just a real cool guy. I really like Chris Rutkowski. In fact, his talk at the UFO Congress was Canadian UFOs, eh? So he does say eh. It's not a... just a mythology or just a legend that Canadians say, hey, they say it often. In fact, this reminds me of a story that I'm going to share with you. I remember getting a call from like a telemarketer or something like that, or maybe I was calling customer service. It's probably more likely. And the guy kept saying, hey. So I said, are you from Canada? And he said, yeah. How did you know? And I said, well, you've said a several times. And he said, really? I did. And I said, yeah, you've said it at least three or four times. He's like, I've tried. He's consciously tries not to say A. And he actually thought he had kicked the habit of saying A. And I unfortunately let him know that you got some work to do. You're still saying A. So, but Canadians are great. They're some of the, they're known for being nice people. So that's not a bad reputation to have. So another show in the can. I hope you enjoyed yourself. I certainly did, as I always do. Thank you so much to Caleb Hanks for the opening and close music. Thank you to Martin Willis for talking to us about UFO news and joining us for that section. That's always a lot of fun. Be sure to to check out openminds.tv for all of the news that we talked about and more. Of course, we add UFO news there daily. Also, you can find our UFO report, which is our YouTube video report that we do weekly. We do have a new one up that we just posted on Friday about the FAA report, where you can see some pictures and maps and stuff like that on the video. So check that out. We do have some other UFO cases on there. We'll have a new one coming up this Friday. And we always have some UFO videos on YouTube. So that's something new that we're doing. We're posting these little vignettes, these little videos on some of the archive photos that we have in our archives. And these are some great cases. These are cases from before Photoshop even existed that are really unexplainable. Some of them are very strange, and they're from all over the world. So you've got to check those out. You can find them on our YouTube, or you can find all of this at openminds.tv or in our Open Minds email newsletter. So if you're not subscribed to our email newsletter, you need to do that. You can go to our webpage, openminds.tv. On the upper right, you're going to see a blue box. It's unmistakable. That says email newsletter, and you can just add your email address to that. And that way, even if you forget, your life gets busy, and you don't have time to check our website or the radio show or any of this, you'll get an email that reminds you, hey, here's some of the cool stuff, some of the cool stories, and cool interviews that we've done in the last couple of weeks. So it helps keep you up to date, because I know how it is. I get really busy, and sometimes just life runs away with you, and your time seems to go. So at least you'll still get that hit of what's going on in the UFO world. Thank you all so much for joining us. I have some great interviews lined up for the next couple of weeks, so be sure to join us. It's going to be a lot of fun. In fact, we've got coming up Robert Hastings. He studies UFOs and nukes, and he has a new documentary out. We're going to be writing about this next week and talking to him about this, because this is really important and great stuff. We've got Rich Hoffman, the state director for Alabama MUFON. He also works on a lot of stuff like the Homeland Security video, a lot of really important stuff. So we'll be talking to him. And we'll be talking to some people about abduction research, a PhD, who believes there's something to this phenomena, is working with a group to investigate. So we've got a lot of really cool stuff coming up, so stay tuned. But I want to thank the most. I want to thank you all for listening. Thank you so much for listening. It's wonderful to have you here every week. And we will talk to you soon. Adios, muchachos.